I've watched so much porn the last 3 days. Like, I'm starting to watch normal movies and, like, wonder, why aren't they having sex yet?
Yeah. Well,
I was watching the 1966 Batman, and I was like, when is Catwoman going to start disrobing?
Where's the bush?
Ooh, all right, then I will start with the little intro here. You ready, Seth?
I am.
Are you fluffed?
I'm fluffed. I heard that's a myth. I heard they don't do that.
I think it's probably mostly pills nowadays. Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, the podcast for films that put the sin in cinema. I am Mark D'Ottavio.
I'm Seth Troyer.
And today we're exploring the golden age of porn, that bygone span in the 1970s when hardcore pornography opened in theaters, sometimes to both commercial and critical success. We'll start off by discussing the unprecedented box office of 1972's The Devil and Miss Jones, and then we'll compare two other touchstones with very different artistic aims. 1976's zany adult comedy, The Opening of Misty Beethoven, and 1978's grim cautionary tale, Her Name Was Lisa. Time to set your tabs to incognito.
Oh my God, I will.
Ooh, good. That was a good one.
Yeah.
My favorite part of this is the corny introduction. That's honestly, I work the hardest on that.
Sin in cinema.
I had to take a break from my go-to for a lot of these movies, effedupmovies.com. And on this one, I had to just hop on over to Spank Bang. So maybe that's our sponsor for this episode. But I thought, you know what? I'm not going incognito. This is for work. This is for the podcast. I'm doing this on the history, on the browser history.
You need the receipts for the taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah, in this way, those sites like, you know, YouPorn and XTube and stuff are actually helping preserve some slice of cinema history by hosting these films, because you're not going to find them on Netflix or Amazon or Hulu. Maybe Hulu.
I was ex-hamster for all of them, which I'm always like, what is the hamster? Why is there a hamster involved? I never understand on that site.
Well, if I could jump in to mention, I had DVDs. So, very classy.
That's way cooler. I was just thinking about while I was watching these, I kind of want to just start a collection. These would be just really fun to have.
Well, they look terrific, so that helps a lot.
I believe you.
Yeah, I watched some transfers that were from like Blu-rays of them and looked really good.
Oh, so, yeah, you know, absolutely, yeah. Restorations.
Yeah, they're restoring even the porno chic era.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, speaking right now is our very special guest, Jetta, joining us from Brooklyn. Jetta, it is so nice to have you.
Thank you.
Others may know you on Letterboxd as the Iron Cupcake.
Indeed.
And I noticed that you have quite a selection on there as far as reviewing like old exploitation movies, even the pornographic films from this era. I mean, am I correct in that? That's almost like what you're drawn to or your expertise in a way?
Well, I'll watch anything. I mean, I'm interested in pretty much anything that piques my interest for whatever reason. But yeah, in particular, I'm drawn to films that challenge notions of what's taboo. I'm always interested in censorship, the history of sex in film. I'm just interested in pretty much everything that covers. So whether it's the pre-code era or films from the 50s and 60s that began to challenge the production code and led to the creation of the rating system, and then porn. There's just so much to think about and, you know, to kind of ask yourself, does this really show what America was like at that time? And I feel like the films we're going to be talking about today are providing a really interesting window into just what was going on in film in the 70s and in pop culture and politics. So, I don't know. There's a lot going on there that I just am fascinated by. So, yeah, my reviews kind of run the gamut.
You know, I'm on this podcast called Unwatchables, and I think you would be perfect.
Thank you.
You should be on it sometime. We're doing a porn episode. So, if you're not doing anything right now, I think you fit right in.
I mean, I've never been on a podcast, so I'm extremely nervous, very anxious, but excited. So somewhere in moderation, I'll figure out the right level.
Pressure's on. Pressure's on.
Yeah. But these movies, you're right. These movies are, if nothing else, time capsules, is either literally in the, you know, the era that you're seeing, but also just in their sensibility. This is a whole disappeared genre, really. And I knew nothing about it. These were my first full-length adult films, at least that I can think of. And, you know, for anybody who's not familiar with that, these are from what is considered the golden age of porn, which roughly, according to Wikipedia, stretches from about 1969 to 1984.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, it's mostly a 70s thing. If you've seen Boogie Nights, that's kind of the era that it's covering in there. And the Burt Reynolds character is always talking about this ideal of, he wants to make a movie that after everyone in the audience gets off, they want to stay in their seats to see what happens in the plot. And that's what these movies are.
Mm-hmm. Watching for the dialogue.
Yeah. And I think that the one that's still most associated with that era is Deep Throat from 1972, which I did not get a chance to watch. And we considered talking about on this podcast, but I ended up being more interested in The Devil and Miss Jones, which is by the same director. And from what I can tell, actually was a bigger box office success even. Although it's a little hard to tell. I think the receipt taking with these movies was not very stringent. There's even some suggestion that they were financed by organized crime.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And there might have even been some money laundering going on. So it's kind of hard to get an exact number. Like The Devil and Miss Jones, like I read some places it was the seventh most successful film of 1973, or maybe it was the 10th. But either way, it still made more money than some like actual classic films that came out that year, which is kind of funny.
Right behind Paper Moon, I think I read.
Nice.
Like somewhere in that range.
Yeah, yeah. Paper Moon and a James Bond film, I think.
Yeah. Live and Let Die.
Yeah.
You gotta keep up. You gotta keep up.
But yeah, we decided against Deep Throat because it didn't sound as interesting. And Linda Lovelace has since stated that she was coerced and even sexually assaulted on camera in it, which kind of just put a bummer over the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was talked about at the time. I mean, right away, she denounced the film. And, you know, I think maybe even a year after having made it or 2 years after, I think she made a few more films, but almost immediately, she claimed that it was coerced in every possible way. And she went on talk shows, wrote a memoir about it. So there are many reasons not to have chosen it for today. I think it's still worth watching just to see what it's like and to have the experience of it, but also a terribly made movie in many ways and not at all reflective of Damiano's artistic abilities. To the extent that you could call them really artistic, The Devil and Miss Jones definitely has more of a sense of, you know, auteurism, I guess. So, yeah, a better choice for sure.
I had no idea it would be so surreal, this movie. I was really pleased, and I didn't realize it was based off of No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre. Like loosely, from what I was reading.
A bit loosely.
real loosey goosey.
It's really more the ending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you can tell there's like some kernels there, and they are just like, even, you know, the departures he's making are these interesting ideas going on. Really unexpected, surreal turns. I love the plot in it. It really commits to the fantastical kind of dreamy atmosphere of the whole thing, which kind of it is interesting. All three of these movies we're covering have like very specific sexual tones, in my opinion. Like this one is very much in like very committed, like erotic, almost like in the realm of fantasy or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Beethoven is more of this like sex comedy, like sort of the silliness of sex, I guess. Finally, her name is Lisa, has more of that like kind of rough, dark, tougher kind of sexuality going on. I found that interesting about these three going together, this threesome.
I think they're great examples of diverse, you know, the different purposes that these movies can have. And I was interested to learn that a lot of this like explosion of these hardcore movies in the 70s was because of a Supreme Court decision, Miller v. California from 1973, that kind of changed the definition of obscenity, or it limited it more so that it would have to be something that had no artistic merit. And I think that these porn movies kind of got around that by saying, look, these do have some sort of artistic merit. There's production value. There's a perspective that they have. There's a script. And that kind of resulted in these movies that were like, all right, we can play in theaters and not get in trouble with the law if we have some sort of way that we can argue that there's more to it than just the purient part, the sex. It's fascinating to me to think about porn as a genre. And in these three different ways, we'll get to explore that. But I don't know. I was trying to think of what, you know, how would you define a porn movie? And I think it's as simple as having the sex scenes in them kind of serve the same way that the action scenes do in an action movie or in a comedy. Whatever, the movie can do whatever else it wants to do. But if it's not aiming for laughs in particular points, then it's not really a comedy. And a slasher film has the set pieces where someone gets killed, and you expect those beats all throughout the movie.
Well, if nothing else, I think I should impress upon you all the fact that Gerard Damiano and Radley Metzger were in the DVD commentary tracks, again, to pretentiously point out that I listened to DVD commentary tracks.
Yeah.
They were both really proud of the fact that every single line of dialogue in both of those films was taken right from the script. They really worked hard on the script. They really wanted the viewers to know that there was so much effort put into everything that was happening on screen. Although there was an improvisation in The Devil and Miss Jones, which we'll get to when we get to that.
Oh, I can't wait.
Hey, I memorized my lines. I hit my mark. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
Real action.
And they, you know,
it's badass.
And Letterboxd now actually lists adult films, or at least certain ones. They made a decision, I think as of last year, that they would list a curated selection of historically, culturally, controversially, and artistically significant adult films. And if nothing else proves that these are being worthy, you know, of evaluation and study and enjoyment, it must be that. Because there's whole communities of people who are wanting to have it be a part, you know, of the cinema lexicon.
It should be. I feel like they've got like commercials you can rate on Letterboxd and shit. So yeah, I've seen all kinds of shit on there.
Yeah, I wish they wouldn't put TV shows on there. I think that's cheating, but
a great controversy. Yeah,
man, don't get everybody started.
And I think that what killed the whole thing was home video, basically, where people did ultimately decide that I would rather watch porn at home without strangers around. And that pretty much, just like you see in Boogie Nights, killed the whole scene. The, you know, they got lower and lower budgets and had no artistic pretensions for them anymore. And then when the internet came along, you know, that just furthered it, I think.
Right. I mean, making films on video rather than on film, all of a sudden there was no longer any pretense as to making real capital F films. It was just, you know, make whatever you make in the shortest amount of time possible. And don't even try to pretend that it's filmmaking. So, you know, once that became the norm, I think there were fewer people who wanted to be directors. It was just a matter of creating content.
Yeah, point and shoot.
So you're not going to see more Radley Metzgers after the 80s.
Yeah, that's too bad. So, but let's go back in time to that glorious era. 1973, The Devil and Miss Jones. You brought up Gerard Damiano, again, who of Deep Throat. And he actually appears in this film. He's the guy in the cell in the opening and ending, mumbling about a fly and refusing to touch poor, what is her name in this film?
Justine Jones.
Justine Jones, played by Georgina Spelvin.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's her stage name, right?
Right, to kind of satirize, I guess, the name George Spelvin, which apparently was often used by theater actors when they played two roles in a play, and they didn't want anyone to know that they were playing the second role. It had to be a big surprise. So they would use George Spelvin in credits. And so I guess Georgina Spelvin figured this is a nice way to pay homage to my theatrical roots.
Yeah, like an Alan Smithy type all-purpose name.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But yeah, the opening of this movie, I think it really grabbed my attention right from the get-go, right? It's so ominous, forlornly masturbating and begging this guy to touch her. And he just is sitting there mumbling like madness about a fly and has no interest in touching her.
The framing foreplay.
Apparently, Damiano didn't... I'm not sure if it's that he didn't want to put that in the film at the time where it is, but he felt years later that it was a mistake to do that. I guess he figured that it was necessary just to keep audiences in their seats for the first 2 minutes. Like, this is going to hook them in more than if you just open with the suicide. But in retrospect, he felt like that was a mistake because it was just kind of cheap. I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting to see the end at the beginning and then to circle back to it.
It's also kind of scary. It's intense.
Yeah.
Like,
ominous. Yeah.
Whoa. And you're only seeing her like face for the most part. And then you get some clips here and there, but it's just like kind of intense and disturbing beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then right into the opening credits that I thought were very cool too. Just elegant. And they had this
satanic.
Yeah. They had this moody, like piano kind of string score underneath it. And I was hooked.
That's another really interesting thing about the film, which, I mean, I don't know if there had never been an adult film at that point that used an original score, but this was the first really major one. And so the idea of not just using a catalog of stock music, actually creating original music to, you know, set the tone, I don't know. I mean, I think that's interesting. It's on Spotify.
Oh, that's awesome.
I liked it. So.
You know, I don't know. You can listen to it all the time.
Yeah, and then after that is this the scene that you were talking about, Seth. This pretty prolonged suicide, basically, where the main character is, you know, gets into a bathtub and slits her wrists. And there's some moody lighting. We get more of that music. There's even a depth of field, like a rack focus shot, like of the razor and her reaching for it, which is like, oh, man.
Yes.
We're not in porn Kansas anymore.
For sure, some lingering on her naked body in the bathtub, which, you know, was always an important thing to remember in 2022, like just how much of a big deal it was to be able to see a naked person on camera, you know, just like, wow. Like, it was just, it just kind of like, it's an easy thing to just like kind of glaze over and be like, yeah, okay, there's some nudity or something, but. Even a like subtle shot like that of just like a lady in a bathtub was probably a bigger deal than we think.
And I think it's also interesting that I don't know if you've read about the history of how Georgina Spelvin was cast in the film, but she had this interesting kind of winding road to getting there wherein she was a dancer, theater actor, didn't really get the job she wanted. So she started working in craft services. I think she actually had some training as a film editor. She had a film collective that made anti-war films, but she was hired as a cook for The Devil and Miss Jones. She was supposed to just, you know, provide craft services. And when I think it was the actor Mark Stevens who appears in the film, he's in the last two sex scenes. He was working with Georgina Spelvin on a previous adult film called The High Priestess of Sexual Witchcraft.
Wow.
Which is amazing. And so he suggested, well, why don't you come work on this film? And that led her to meeting Gerard Damiano, reading some lines, just like as a favor to work with another actor. And everyone realized, oh, my God, she's Justine Jones. But unfortunately, also, when you listen to interviews with Gerard Damiano, apparently nobody thought that she was pretty. And so all of Gerard Damiano's discussions of what an incredible performance she gave, starting right at the top with that suicide scene, is all given with the asterisk of, well, she did pretty well. She was pretty incredible, even though she wasn't pretty. And Harry Reams even said at the time, well, she's totally flat-chested and she, you know, is so totally plain. What are we going to do with her? And so it's just so fascinating to think of that first scene and how impactful it is just from a dramatic perspective. I mean, that's tough when you're watching that scene and you're thinking about this being an adult film meant to titillate. I mean, that's just, it's so dark. It's just so depressing. But I just think it's so interesting that she was able to convey so much emotion. And at the same time, the director and other cast members were thinking, well, if only she were a little better in this one department. So, I don't know. What do we do with all that information?
No, I mean, I was going to say she's my favorite lead of all three of the movies we watched. I think it is partially like, yeah, she looks sexy to me. I find her sexy. But for me, it's about her commitment and her acting and like the way she can just like really get in there with the way she speaks during the sex scenes just is so convincing. She's amazing in this, I think.
Well, she has said in interviews it was all acting. Apparently, she never took any pleasure from any of the sex scenes she made at all in her career, and she really only began to experience whatever heights of ecstasy she was performing in film when she met her husband in the 80s. So it's all an incredible act.
Oh, so she wasn't really that into snakes or grapes and bananas.
Well, that's an interesting
thing. I do want to get to the snake thing, but just in case anyone who's listening hasn't seen this movie, the next scene is her just in like an office where she's basically being processed in the afterlife and finds out she's going to hell because she committed suicide. But otherwise, she has a totally clean record and died a virgin. So the guy sends her, basically allows her to return. It's not totally clear to Earth or wherever, so that she can have a bunch of sexual adventures before she has to go to hell anyway.
She wants lust.
Yeah, she wants lust.
She demands lust.
And from that point on, it's basically a scene after scene after scene after scene of different sex scenes. We've got, you know, just her with a guy, her with a girl, her by herself, her with a girl and a guy, her with two guys, her with a snake, and some fruit. And yeah, so what were you going to say about the snake scene, which I was not, that made me uncomfortable.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. That was the one improvised scene in the film, despite Gerard Damiano's insistence that everything be, you know, right to the letter. Apparently, the snake belonged to Mark Stevens, who, besides being the person who brought Georgina Spelvin to the set, he was also just an outrageous character. I mean, he basically wanted to be the first porn superstar. He wrote two memoirs in the 70s, so that kind of makes you wonder, you know, did he really deserve that? But he was a fascinating figure. He wanted to just be as wild and outlandish as possible. And so, long story short, he had a pet snake named Herman. And for whatever reason, he felt like he needed to bring the snake to Pennsylvania when they shot all of the scenes in that, you know, whether it's Earth or whatever it is, all of those scenes were in Pennsylvania. He brought the snake with him, and Georgina Spelvin was just, you know, petting the snake at one point while people were setting up in between scenes, and Damiano saw it and thought, oh, amazing, we've got to start doing something with this. This is going to be amazing cinema. Whether or not that's true, you know, I guess we can decide for ourselves. But everyone thought it fit in with this, I don't know, like a Garden of Eden idea. It's the serpent, part of her descent into sin, I guess, maybe, kind of debatable.
Yeah, she kind of like puts its head like in her mouth and
yeah, not great, really not great.
I was glad it didn't go further than that, though.
Nobody was monitoring. Yeah.
No, the Humane Society was not on set for this, probably. So yeah, in general, I would say like what we described through the opening, through the suicide, is like the first 9 minutes of the movie. And the next like 5 minutes is her being interviewed and, you know, finding out she's going to hell and everything, which is a scene I think looks a little cheaper with a little shakier acting, at least with the guy that she's talking to.
I love that hazy 70s sun, though.
Sure.
I'm just a slut for that.
And then from that point on, my impression is that the whole rest of the movie is just scenario after scenario without really any context. So it's like we just you know, crossfade into her with this guy who calls himself the teacher and them having sex for a very long time. And
well, she's got to learn.
And then her with just crossfades to girls rubbing lotion on each other.
Mm-hmm. I love that. It's a glistening, like crazy looking scene. Again, the haze, the 70s haze in this movie, at least on the version that I watched, I just really loved.
Yeah, I think that's how it always looks, no matter what you're watching, because I think the film is in the public domain, so nobody has ever really been able to restore it. It just kind of looks like what it looks like.
But also,
I think that Damiano didn't really, I don't think he designed the look of the film. He kind of left it up to the cinematographer, who is also another really interesting figure in just like general film history, Joao Fernandez, who worked in a lot of adult films in the 70s and then went on to do Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter,
yeah,
and Children of the Corn.
I read that. Films I know very well in my horror-watching childhood.
And my personal favorite, The Prowler. Amazing movie. But he was basically responsible for all of the lighting and framing. So it's not really clear to me if Damiano had any ideas about anything more than just like pointing and shooting the camera. But yeah, I mean, I think that that natural light kind of look is, you know, part of what makes the film, I don't know if you want to say special, but it, you know, it's memorable for sure.
I like how it's all sort of stream of consciousness, almost the way the sex scenes and everything are edited together, and they flow. She's like wandering in and out of one or the other sexual encounter or sexual experiment. And I think it only adds to the dream nature of the whole thing.
And I think there's a comfort in particular in that glistening scene with Claire Lumiere. I don't remember what her real name was, but that scene, she was actually Georgina Spelvin's roommate. And they were in a relationship at the time, so that's how she got the job on the film. I think she was also supposed to do craft services, which was $25 a day. But when she was told that she could be in this scene, then that was $100. So she said, sure, why not? I mean, they were already comfortable with each other. And I think that adds to the feeling of that whole scene, besides the music, which also, you know, creates a lot of that mood. But just knowing that those two performers were already intimately involved and had that emotional connection, I think makes it work even better.
And man, look at the craft service industry just turning out porn stars.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's your way up.
Yeah.
I mean, not for nothing, there were a lot of people who worked in adult film at the time who had drama degrees from colleges. They studied acting. They really wanted to be legitimate, quote unquote, actors. So yeah, craft services or theater or both.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing I guess the most I got out of those scenes is that they do kind of like pick a different kind of music and tone for each one. And there's one scene in particular, it's just her masturbating in a bathtub and with a water hose. And
yeah,
there's these just like mournful horns and electric guitar that I swear sounds just like the Once Upon a Time in the West soundtrack.
Yes, yes, it is almost exactly.
Which is one of my favorite all-time soundtracks. Yeah, it's just weird to hear that over what we're seeing. You know, it does add a atmosphere to it that you wouldn't normally get from this kind of thing.
Yeah, there's like a weird ennui, like almost not depressive, but a somber sort of melancholy to some of it.
Well, I think Damiano wanted to use even more recognizable music than that to reel audiences in, because another thing that I heard him speak about on the DVD was that he edited that suicide scene at the beginning to Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Whoa.
Oh, my
so
God.
He wanted that in the film. He really thought that would make it.
Badass.
Specifically Roberta Flack's version of it. but he couldn't afford it. So I'm sure that the fact that that other piece sounds so exactly like Morricone was intentional. I think he really wanted that specific atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah, the music does mean a lot. There's a lot of yearning that comes out of it. There is a desperation, and the scenes get more and more like intense and desperate, because you do feel like maybe in the background, in the back of her head, she is remembering that she only has a short time in this world of lust before she goes to hell. But before that, you see some stuff that you would be surprised to even find now in 2022 on your regular Pornhub search. Wow.
I think it's just all part of wanting to push boundaries. Just like do whatever you think will shock viewers and get the critics a buzz. And there were critics. There were critics writing about these in the newspapers. So
I have Roger Ebert's positive 3-star review of this pulled up right now. And that was another reason I was very interested in this, because he didn't like Deep Throat, but he gave this a review, which, I mean, it is a little measured. He's mainly holding it to the standard of other hardcore films at the time, and was just impressed with the performance and how it didn't seem totally exploitative and grim and basic. But he was a fan, and I have to say, personally, I was disappointed that once the sex scenes start, they're never really situated back into a story or anything. As they went on and on and on, I was starting to feel like all that we really got cinematically was this opening. And then it ends up just being an excuse to get to scene after scene after scene. And I did get a little restless as it started going on, especially since, you know, I think there's more dynamically shot sex scenes in the other movies than these in general. And, you know, maybe it's just a personal thing too, that again, this is a hardcore movie. So we're talking like extreme close-ups of just genitals slapping together. It's very anatomical. And for me, that kind of just like explicitness is not really erotic. And it's more like I'm going to medical school or something when they have such a focus on that. And so, yeah, that's why I was not as taken with this as Seth was, but I was by the first 9 minutes at least.
Different strokes.
Oh, Jesus. Nice one.
Well, you know, Damiano seemed to think that his greatest skill as a filmmaker was his editing. And I would argue that there are a lot of scenes in Devil that just go on forever. I mean, they should have been edited more. I mean, shots don't necessarily have to last that long. So for sure, compared to the other two films, this one, it's a little rudimentary. It definitely could have used more plot, could have used a little more, I don't know, verve in some department. It definitely is not as good as Damiano eventually became with some later films. So it's hard for me to kind of divorce my knowledge of what he later did with, you know, enjoying this film for what it is.
I think that makes this a good introduction to this kind of movie, too, because it does split the difference a bit as far as you can tell the difference it's making by subtly adding in these other elements that weren't there with just run-of-the-mill pornos before.
And at last, great fucking representation. There's just not enough having sex with grapes in porn, and this movie has that.
And of course, she's got to eat them afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
You should have heard me go, oh.
There's bananas going inside her.
Yeah.
She eats the banana.
That's art, man.
You can't be half-hearted when you do those kinds of scenes. You just have to, you know, do as much as humanly possible, I guess.
Whatever it takes to get people to eat their fruits and vegetables, you know?
You can have your own purgatory dream, okay? This is mine.
Yeah, but I think that's the tendency, at least with this particular movie, is to kind of grade it on a curve. That was the idea that I got from the Ebert review, that is like, oh, look how much closer this is inching towards being an actual movie. And I guess it just depends how much that particular aspect means to you, as opposed to maybe it doesn't get there all the way, but it's in comparison to other porn, I think, is where this really shines.
Yeah, it just felt like an arty movie with a lot of sex in it, kind of.
Yeah, whole lot. So, and again, the ending, which is spoiled by the beginning, I guess, but that is really the main point of interest, where she's finally like, all right, I guess I'm ready to go to hell now. And it ends up being her alone in this cell with some guy who she desperately is trying to get to touch her and has no interest. He just wants to talk about a fly that comes out when he closes his eyes, like mad ramblings. And I guess that's supposed to be her hell now, is that she wants sex and this guy won't give it to her.
Yeah, and is it he needs to like quiet her down or something? He's like, quiet down. And she's just like masturbating herself. And she's just like, please, come on. And he's just like, please, be quiet. I'm trying to find this fly.
Yeah, not even any fruit or snakes. So even on her own.
Yep.
She's out of luck.
Well, everyone has their own private hell, because in Damiano's view, there are, 33 flavors of Baskin-Robbins. So for as many different flavors of ice cream as there are, you know, many, well, infinitely more possibilities for the kinds of hells that you could be stuck in. And in particular for me, I think of that line in Psycho about everyone being stuck in their own private traps and no one can get out. So, you know, it just is what it is in the end.
Yeah, and that's the most no exit thing about this, I guess. So we do like to ask at the end of each discussion for each film is if you would unwatch it if you could. So, Jed, if we want to start with you.
I would definitely watch it again. I've seen it before. May possibly see it again if I feel like I could get something else out of it. I will say, because I forgot to mention this earlier, one of the absolute funniest things to me is that Damiano did not have a share in the profits. So he didn't see really any money from the extraordinary success of it because he just didn't think to. He didn't think to ask. Like, he just got paid right up front from the producers, I guess, and went on his merry way. But then when the movie made $15 million, you know, then he had to get lawyers, and he ended up getting $100,000, but then he had to pay $50,000 to the lawyers. So he didn't get anything else really out of that besides that. So I guess I would rewatch the film thinking about the fact that Gerard Damiano is, well, he was for decades still mad about that. And that was kind of like the overwhelming feeling he had about it. And he couldn't get the success he thought he deserved out of it.
Man, I feel like most of that money should have gone to the craft services because they got their money's worth. All right. And Seth.
Yeah, like I said, I liked this one quite a bit, again, for its earnestness and it just being kind of just weird. It's just a real oddity and it's real sexy. So I'm going to be kind of into that. Yeah, I don't know. I would watch it again, maybe even soon. Who knows, though? You know, it might be like a second date that just is not like the first one. we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and I don't know. I was a little torn because I'm glad to finally be exploring this scene. And again, it has a striking opening. But I guess just like statistically, most of it I was not really wanting to watch. So maybe just in the percentage of this film, I would probably be happy to unwatch. But that takes us to our next film, which is the opening of Misty Beethoven, which I honestly can't imagine that there would be like a better argument for this genre. And I was surprised by just how much of a blast I had with this movie. And I am so glad that we included it because we got a full out comedy, freewheeling 70s comedy, full of hardcore sex. And you know, we got a higher budget, I think stronger acting and material and visual sense to it. And I am a fan of Misty Beethoven.
It's witty. It's silly. Love it.
I mean, it's international. It's globe hopping. You know, how could you do better than that?
We got New York, Paris, Rome. It feels like this must have had a bigger budget than the other ones that we watched.
Well, I don't know how much it cost. But Metzger, I think, when he was asked about it, said he couldn't remember how much it cost. So that'll give you some idea. No expense spared.
And I think just in general, the fact that the sex in here is just more just joyous and lighthearted and even funny, which I just really liked. Sometimes a lot of times it functions as a punchline, or it's there for just the pure absurdity of it, where they're walking around a mansion and there's just always a maid blowing a servant somewhere in the background.
Eternal head. There's just so much head being given in this movie.
Well, servants, service. Makes sense.
Yes.
And basically, this is a Pygmalion My Fair Lady story where a sexologist, Dr. Seymour Love, meets this kind of a low-rent sex worker who's not very good at her job, and he wants to turn her into this sex goddess and takes her to this like sex school. And gives her these challenges of, you know, seducing different people. And it just goes from there. And I feel like this has more in common with a movie like Airplane or like a Zucker's Brothers type movie than like The Devil.
Airplane. And quite literally at certain points, they had that airplane set that they're on. That is like a real airplane set that they're in. And it's like a sex airplane where the stewardesses come around and they're like, what would you like? And you're allowed to just like ask for head or like ask to put something in her ass or something like that.
And it actually was a real airplane. They actually were able to get one, but they had to lie about what they were doing.
So wild. Yeah, there's like full on like sex and stuff going on. Lovely.
That contains one of the funniest jokes in the movie to me, which is when she comes over and says, would anybody like to fuck a stewardess? And then however that scene winds up, the guy pulls out a cigar holder and hands it to her, and she just, you know, dutifully bends over and puts it in her butt and then walks away. And the woman sitting next to the guy on the plane says, like, why'd she do that? And he says, oh, that's a Jamaican cigar. She smuggles them across the, you know, customs line for me. And then the woman goes, wait, it's not illegal to import Jamaican cigars. And the guy goes, shh.
It's such that's a good, pretty good scene.
A lot of my favorite stuff is on the plane. Everything on the plane is gold. Like, mm-hmm. as soon as we cut to it, a stewardess is done servicing a passenger and just gets up and is like, all right, now who gets the vodka? And keeps giving out drinks.
I want a sequel, Sex Plane.
Yeah.
And the fact that Mark Margolis is there, who became an actually well-known character actor, the guy who's mad that he didn't get two blowjobs, just like seeing him, it's always fascinating when every now and then you'll see someone who actually got a mainstream career, they'll just pop up in one of these movies because it was the beginning of their, you know, long and storied career.
Yeah, didn't Sylvester Stallone start out in a porno?
Mm-hmm.
He did, and it is unbelievably bad. So bad. Like, you should watch it because it's so bad. The Party at Kitty and Studs.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, yeah, horrible, horrible.
Italian Stallion. What's the guy's name who's, like, the sexologist? Seymour?
Jamie Gillis.
Oh, he reminded me of, like, Elliot Gould or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Jamie Gillis as the sexologist gives my favorite performance in all three of these movies, honestly, because he doesn't start having sex, I think, with people for a little bit into the movie. And you're right. He totally reminded me of like Dustin Hoffman or Elliot Gould. And he has this just this really funny way of delivering lines and being this hoity-toity guy. And I think he's, yeah, this is actually a really good comic performance. I was almost disappointed at a certain point when he started just participating in the sex scenes. I was like, I was enjoying you more, like being funny.
Got a nice dick, too.
And apparently, may I say, he was so proud of his work in this film that when he won an acting award for it, I guess from whatever Adult Film Association of America kind of ceremony existed at the time, he kept it on his mantle at home. He wanted everyone to see it. He wanted everyone to know. He was so proud of his performance in this.
He did great.
Yeah, he was wonderful. And I think everybody is pretty good. I think he shines the most.
I do like Misty Beethoven. She's lovely. She does a great job. She is funny. I love her in the montage, the opening montage of them just like
sex training montage,
showing her how to do everything in this weird, like what feels like a porn castle or something. Like, her, like, practicing on these, like, rainbow dildo things and popsicles and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and I want to spotlight the editing in this movie because it has this such a – it's so snappy and has this playful rhythm all throughout. From the very first scene, which is Dr. Love just strolling past the sex shops in downtown Paris and on intercut with – this sex scene that we aren't sure like where it's happening. And he eventually wanders into a porn theater and it turns out that's what's showing on screen. And right from that part, we have this funny juxtaposition. And then this old guy walks in and gets and like reveals that he's in a Napoleon costume. And right from that moment, I was like, oh, this is fun. She's like, excuse me, I have to go give Napoleon a hand job, which is then intercut with a guy getting a hand job in the movie.
And there's even a match cut to something happening on screen, like that salute that, yeah.
Yeah, sure is.
Incredible.
Yeah, I couldn't believe the editing. It was so startling to see it in a porno. Like, it's all these, like, parallel action going on and, like, one thing happening, cutting back to another thing. It's just really wild. You don't get to see that a lot. And it's really effective also for the eroticism, because you're getting like multi-layers of stimulation, lots going on all at once.
And Misty also wears that incredible t-shirt with the credit cards on it to highlight the transactional nature of her work.
Yes.
Love that.
Oh, yeah.
Love it, Misty. Own it.
And then just the script itself is just so sharp and has all of these great one-liners in it. I think probably the one that people quote the most is something that like Woody Allen could have written like in his prime, basically when they're landing in Rome and she's like, what's the difference between New York and Rome? And he's like, there aren't as many Italians in Rome. And I'm like, that's an A plus joke.
Knee slapper.
No sex at all. And yeah, it's just full of stuff like this. This is Geraldine Rich. She's very Geraldine and very rich. And it's just, I think he wrote a book called The Annals of Passion.
Mm-hmm.
In his expertise.
And she seduces a gay guy at one of her challenges. That's pretty, that's a wild little scene.
Another, fascinating thing, because Casey Donovan was one of the most famous figures in the gay film world at that time, you know, for having been in Boys in the Sand by Wakefield Pool. He was like one of the faces of gay porn at the time. And so the idea that he would be in this, he knew Radley Metzger from having been in the earlier film Score, but just the idea that he would want to be in this, and I mean, I don't know. Why did he? That's a good question. But entertaining. I love the eyeshadow.
Amazing.
It's like it's a mad, 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 mad world of porn. Everyone popping up.
I was gonna say that, yeah.
And I believe it's with him too that they like she basically practices giving him oral sex by giving oral sex to a woman in a scene before that. And she's following these instructions like on an earpiece. It's basically like Cyrano de Bergerac with mm-hmm. porn or Roxanne.
Kind of a bit of a spy movie thing going on, that whole like, you know, infiltrating his place and seeing what's happening there. All of the stuff with Terry Hall guiding her along. I don't know. There's a kind of an espionage sort of a feel to it, I think. Getting intel.
There's also a funny scene with a guy who, like, is with her at the opera, and he's known for, like, whenever he's ready to go, he's got to go get off as soon as possible. So they're, like, getting up and making people stand up and trying to get out of the row of seats. But then also, if he doesn't get to it soon enough, he loses interest. So then they turn back around or making everyone stand up again to go sit down.
And then he's like, oh, I'm hard again. Let's go. Like, oh, I got soft again. Nope, I gotta go sit down.
And there's a scene that's not very funny, but it's when she eventually seduces this guy and his right-hand woman, and they have a threesome, like, near the end. And I don't know, was this the first, like, big porno movie with pegging in it? Where she straps on and has her way with him?
At least the second. There was one before it.
Oh.
So, there you go. Trivia. Don't know when you'll need to use it, but there you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a big modern move to have your climactic sex scene involve pegging. Well, it's like a threesome, too, happening at the same time when she has the thing on and fucking him, you know? Intense.
And I think that was the purpose, really, of Casey Donovan being in the film, because he had to double for the actor who was in that scene who refused to do anything more than the straight sex. So
I figured that was what was going on. It's like, all right, but I better be fucking some lady if I'm going to get that up my ass. I got to say, I love the bushes in these movies. And just when you really get these close-ups of just mashing genitals together, you really do see how things have changed in porn filmmaking. Things are lit in such different ways, and I don't know, like, everybody's just groomed in such a different way now, it feels like, in, like, your average, like, model Pornhub clip that you would watch.
I think I read that, like, 60% of the production budget for these movies went to pubic hair.
It's very, very 70s in that way, yeah. Lots of body hair in these movies. And nobody is, like, covered in tattoos like you would see a lot in, you know.
It feels more naughty.
And I think a lot of the men who worked in these films, they often kind of felt like they were just furniture. They were really just there to support the women who presumably the audiences wanted to see more. So I don't know. It's always kind of interesting to me to try to judge. Well, I mean, there were attractive men in there too. And so, you know, what did the audience think? And were the men really just kind of invisible except for, you know, the sex purpose? I mean, I'm sure there had to be somebody in the audience who felt like the men were worth watching, too. And I think that there's something just, as you say, really interesting about, yeah, how real everyone looks. And I mean, that's kind of what makes, I think, the 70s adult film era so special. I mean, it's before our conception of what porn is now, you know, the way the bodies are presumably supposed to look in those films.
I feel there are very different standards for the men and women in these movies, because there are some good looking guys, but they also, it's pretty much open season for, they can bring in some like kind of not conventionally attractive, you know, kind of pudgy guy with a big mustache who will come in, you know, in the way that like Ron Jeremy became a porn star. And it's just not the kind of thing that you really see today, but the women tend to have more of a conventional like attractiveness about them. And the guys are like, we're just here to party.
Well, I think it's also worth noting that Jamie Gillis was a real superstar at the time. Apparently, when he was in Rome for those scenes in Misty Beethoven, there was a moment when he was supposed to be on set and Metzger couldn't start filming because Gillis was surrounded by people just like flocking to him in the street because they recognized him from all the other movies he'd made up until that point, and they wanted his autograph. So clearly he had some appeal.
That makes sense because he's, you know, the rare full package, if you will, that has can actually act and be funny and charming and, you know, is a good looking guy, and he can definitely perform in those scenes, you know, where he has to have sex. So it's pretty much everything you could ask for from an adult film star. Yeah, so I definitely enjoyed this a lot and thought that it has the most story and you know, like arc of all of the movies. And really, the only thing that stopped me from liking this more is that it does, like, I don't know, after like the 35-minute mark, it does start to have more just extended regular sex scenes where there's nothing funny happening. They're definitely better filmed, I think, than in The Devil and Miss Jones. But it does start to feel a little like it is checking off the boxes to make sure they're getting the long sex scenes in. And honestly, it had me thinking about Marvel movies, and follow me here, but, you know, every once in a while, a Marvel movie comes out where there's, you know, they have a good director and they have this kind of slant on it. And it's always like the first 45 minutes or so that is like, oh man, this is really funny or stylish, or you can kind of see their imprint. And then it gets to a point where they got to start throwing in, you know, all of the plot stuff. They've got to have the big CGI fight scenes that take over the whole like last act. And they're just, you know, spraying the colors and light beams at each other. And maybe that's kind of the same thing with some of these hardcore films where eventually they do need to kind of fulfill their contract where they have to make sure there's at least like, you know, three or four or five just long graphic sex scenes that aren't necessarily doing much for the story or being funny or anything. And I did feel like those started to stack up a little bit as this goes on. So that would be my main criticism, really. And that even though this doesn't break 90 minutes, still a little too long, or at least feels that way because of that. I don't know. I would love for all of these porno movies to be like, you know, just like around an hour or a little under length, maybe.
So The Devil and Miss Jones, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. If that had more going on during those parts. But that was my main thing. And I honestly would still rather watch one of these than a Marvel movie. So
yeah, definitely.
Well, I mean, that is the toss up though for me with this one. Again, in comparison to Devil and Miss Jones, it is, I get what you're saying. It is getting to that point where it just needs to like do its function, but that is like a big part of the movie, and that is like I can't fault it for that. I guess it is like it's getting down to the line. It's time to make people come, or probably at this point come again, you know, and in a bigger way. And it's probably, you know, more difficult, and they got to up the stakes at this point, get a little bit more serious. Again, I think I like this movie more as a movie, I guess, and that is the toss-up. But for it being erotic to me, the jokes do get kind of in the way. The real movie aspect of it kind of gets in the way of it maybe being more of a sexy movie to me.
I guess it's just like comedy in general. It's subjective, you know? Not everyone's porn set piece is going to be as erotic. Maybe, you know, some people are turned on by the you know, the flippantness and the funniness of things, and then other people, it kind of shuts them off.
Well, it's It's so beautifully photographed. I feel like you could, even in moments where it seems like, you know, maybe the editing should be a little better, it's just so gorgeously lit and it's so beautifully photographed, you could just focus on the images and that would be impressive. And I mean, worth noting also, another case of the cinematographer really being in charge of everything as far as, you know, how it would be lit and how everything would be set up. And Paul Glickman, another guy who went on to work in mainstream movies, or at least B movies, because he also did a lot of things with Larry Cohen, like God Told Me To and The Stuff. So interesting also to think about this cinematographer having such a strong sensibility and, you know, creating imagery that I think is part of what makes the film so just continually entertaining.
All right, yeah. So I'm definitely not unwatching this. This is actually the one I can imagine returning to or watching with other people.
Yeah, it could be a good party movie, actually.
Yeah. So three thumbs up for this one. Three watches.
I think so.
Oh yeah.
Cool. And I think this makes for a really great contrast then with our final movie, which was from 1979. We're kind of closing in towards the end of this era. And this is called Her Name Was Lisa, which is totally diametrically opposed to this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And reading about it, it made me, you know, interested in it for that reason. So right now we're dealing with Roger Watkins, credited, I guess, as Richard Mahler or Mahler when this movie first came out.
Richard Mahler, because what could be more pretentious than, you know, Richard Wagner and Gustav Mahler, incredible composers. So, you know, of course, that's where the pseudonym would come from.
Yes. Although, of course, he's Dick Mahler.
Mm. Sure.
It's all music to my ears.
Yeah. And I haven't seen any of his other movies, but I have read about The Last House on Dead End Street.
Oh, yes.
That he did a few years before, which is like a horror movie, right?
Yeah. I mean, some people think it's a masterpiece. I found it incredibly boring. So who knows?
I'm very curious.
Well, I mean, the adult films he made, which he didn't seem to care for, and he was embarrassed that he had to make them to support his family, those look fantastic. And they're so superior. I don't know. Just fascinating what has ended up being his legacy.
Well, and this one is pretty grim, too. It basically centers around a framing device where the titular Lisa is already dead. We see her corpse right away, and she spends the movie in a casket with different characters coming to visit her, and they each kind of have a flashback telling the story of how she got there.
It's immediately somber, immediately a bummer, kind of.
Although you do see her naked corpse at first, because we got to check off that box.
Mm-hmm. Which is a cool shot. It's like feels like a Dario Argento lo-fi shot.
So basically, we go one flashback at a time here, so I guess that's kind of how we can approach this, but it starts with this photographer who meets Lisa in like a brothel and invites her to take nude pictures of her because he sees something special in her. And
he's the worst actor I've ever seen in a movie. It's wild.
I was going to say.
Like, reading cue cards.
Like every time they cut back to him, I feel like we're in like a different movie or something, or like he's just in a different scene in a different room. Like he's just so monotone. It's nuts.
He looks like the eldest son from the Brady Bunch, which I find just so disturbing.
You'd think that boy would grow up better.
Yeah, I found him to be one of the best looking guys in these movies. And at the same time, he gives like the most wooden, just porn performance that you could have ever seen.
Just
seeing Samantha Fox as Lisa like act opposite him, and it's like they're in different movies, like where she's trying to be naturalistic and just have a conversation, and he is just, well, how am I supposed to feel?
And he's supposed to have this, like, kind of, I don't know, like, a little bit of a power dynamic going on, and you just don't buy it at all. Like, him as, like, this, like, I am a photographer, I am holding the camera now kind of thing. There's just not even an ounce of Eros to be found or any sort of power in that guy. It's weird.
Yeah, and of course, her audition for him ends up being a long, long sex scene between the two of them. Although before that is one of my favorite parts, though. It's very brief, but when we first see him doing this like photo shoot,
yes,
with these other women, and they're like, you know, one of them's like holding a gun against the other's head and they're like smearing blood all over themselves, and it's set to a Kraftwerk song.
Yeah,
which blew my mind.
I could not believe it. It took me so long. I was like, man, the soundtrack is slapping. Who is this no-name artist who died in poverty, like, made yeah. porn music? I need to find them. And all of a sudden, it's We Are the Robots. Oh, my yes. God. I couldn't believe it.
I don't know how he afforded. How did Watkins afford the soundtrack of this film?
Yeah, Led Zeppelin is in here, too.
Yeah.
Dazed and Confused.
I lost my mind when this is skipping way to the end, and all of a sudden, Dazed and Confused, after all these stories of year of like decades of how nobody could afford Led Zeppelin music, like to clear it for their movies, until they finally started letting them use original recordings. I just figured there's no way they got the rights to this stuff. They must have just put it in.
Isn't that like a big thing? I watched that in like the School of Rock special features where they had to do like a whole video, like, that they sent, like, asking Jimmy Page if they could use
yes.
the immigrant song in School of Rock. And it's, like, all these kids, like, please, Mr. Jimmy Page. And, like, this porno just gets to have, like, it's really uncomfortable, like, climactic scene to Dazed and Confused. Just, there you go.
And it's not even the first adult film that used it. There was actually one before it. I'm pretty sure it's used in Bijou by Wakefield Pool. These directors, they had something going there.
Was this some mafia stuff here where
could
like...
be. Could be.
Or whatever, you know, label executive owned these recordings, was blackmailed or something.
Maybe so.
But anyways, those two sequences, and we'll talk about the Dazed and Confused sequence later, I think, for me, were really the only things that stood out that much to me cinematically. But otherwise, and maybe you guys disagree, but eventually the photographer is kind of forced to introduce her to this rich magazine publisher who, again, has a long, long sex scene with her.
That whole scene's really funny. He really, like, butts his way in and he's like, all right, son, go get us a sandwich or something. And yes, you'll be gone for a half hour. That's fine. And like, we know what's going to happen. And the photographer leaves and... Yeah, the guy has this really silly, like, mustache. I kind of like him. He's very striking. Kind of has a weird way of delivering his lines.
He has a Ron Jeremy yeah. air to him.
He's very flat. Yes, very matter of fact. Very matter of fact.
It's kind of mesmerizing the way he just sort of, you know, swoons and trips through those lines. Mm-hmm. I don't know what he thought he was doing, but it's yeah. very entertaining.
It almost works.
Especially in comparison to the photographer, too. It's like, hey, somebody who can read lines is here.
That might be part of it.
Oh, yeah, it's like
it.
The air in the room changes when he shows up.
For sure.
Yeah, it's nuts.
And he's in a lot of the movie. He's like a main character from that point.
Yeah, I figured she would climb to like, okay, next one, next one, next one. But it does kind of, yeah, I expected it to go a lot more places. And maybe it was because I watched it after Misty Beethoven, which is just like a mile a minute, just like so much happening. But this one just kind of has like a few set pieces, really.
Yeah, she moves in with this guy. There's another long like BDSM sex scene between them where she finds some leather dominatrix gear, straps him down to the bed.
Definitely for me, she's beautiful. I think she is pretty beautiful in this leathery gothy outfit. She did a great job.
With that kind of purple lipstick.
Yeah, great makeup.
And the lighting that lights her from below.
Best part.
Yeah.
And it is kind of weird how we never see the photographer again because it seems like he feels some kind of betrayal when she goes off with him. And I'm not sure if we're meant to think that she had something more real going on with him or if he was just a stepladder.
Yeah, I thought he would come back and ice the guy with the mustache or something, but no.
Yeah, he's gone forever.
Well, I don't think he could do anything more in the story. I mean, I guess he like did as much as he could. He offered as much as he could and he's out. I mean, other people have bigger plans for her, ultimately.
I feel like he could have made his performance make more sense if he did come back as, like, a psychopath and, like, you know, you kicked me out, you know, and then he, like, I don't know, kills the mustache guy. I think that I would have, then his performance would make sense as a stilted, like, psychopath or something. But now he's just a guy who can't act in my head.
Yeah, it just seems like they're setting up a conflict that never nope. gets followed through with. But she seems to be happy going with this guy. And then she meets Carmen, this other female character, at a spa who will eventually become a more significant character. And then we get this scene where things go south and she's given some kind of pills by the magazine guy, and essentially is a rape scene where two guys come over and she is essentially assaulted by them. And I am curious to get everybody's thoughts about this, because that is a really touchy topic of having a scene like that in a porn that's supposed to be erotic in general as a movie. And, you know, it seems to me like the scene is still filmed pretty much like all the other sex scenes, except there's some more, like, you know, leering shots of the guys' faces and some verbal protests from her. But this would be very easy for someone who would just get off on that kind of thing to enjoy. But I don't know. Maybe, do you think there's anything else going on there?
Oh, well, I feel like there are a lot of films from this era that eroticize any kind of sexual assault. They'll just find whatever excuse they can to turn the pain into pleasure and to make it into something that the woman really wants to have happen. And I feel like the film doesn't go there. It makes it pretty clear that she doesn't like what's happening. She is grimacing throughout, trying to, you know, at points claw her way away from them, but of course it doesn't work. And I feel like that's important. You know, just adding to that discomfort and the realization of what's really happening and that there's just no enjoyment at all. Very important. In fact, getting back to Jamie Gillis, he was in a lot of films where he played sadists. A lot of films. That was kind of like his thing. Misty Beethoven is sort of an outlier compared to what he usually did. And so, you know, thinking about all the films that he was in and other actors who made careers out of playing those kinds of characters, it's really uncomfortable. And yeah, it makes you wonder, what is the audience feeling? I mean, in 1979 or now, how are they sitting with this? How are they processing it when there's been all this other presumably consensual content between the characters? It also probably, for me at least, helped that I knew that one of the two actors playing the rapists was Samantha Fox's partner, Bobby Astor, aka the clown prince of porn. So the fact that he was in a relationship with her, and maybe it also helps that I've seen him in other films where he is a hilarious and delightful character, so kind of softens my general image of him. And so it makes it just a little bit easier knowing that the two actors were aware of what they could or could not do and what they were comfortable with, I think.
Yeah, it's really just the fact that this is in a porno, you know, that makes you think a little bit. But, you know, in real life, I mean, there are normal people who have sexual fantasies, you know, about a rape or being raped even, which doesn't mean they actually want to be in real life. That's just like a fantasy scenario that in a safe way they can play out while still realizing all of the real life implications of it. So I don't know, if somebody does get excited by that scene, doesn't necessarily mean that they are a sex criminal or something. And in this context, things are pretty, you know, artificial too. So maybe it even helps soften it that it's a porno, you know, and we're not taking it quite as dramatically seriously as we might otherwise. But it's two sides to everything, you know?
Yeah, it could run into the wrong person. But I don't know if I would necessarily fault the filmmakers for that necessarily.
Well, just knowing that there were films, I mean, getting back to talking about Deep Throat and the controversy of what really happened with Linda Lovelace, just knowing that there were sets where people were doing things that they weren't actually comfortable with, but they just went along with it and they just hated it. And so, I mean, knowing, I guess, just for me, that there was that extra layer helps a little, makes it just a little bit less uneasy.
Yeah, I'm glad you illuminated that too.
Yeah, that is good to know. And then the next scene we get is her running into Carmen again in the spa, and she immediately has a sex scene with her, which I guess, you know, you could look as being something that's a little healing, or her being with somebody that she was actually interested in.
I kind of like that. It was kind of sweet or something in this sort of way of, yeah, it's like she finds solace with someone after a horrible event. Not that it's like a really well put together scene or anything, or really deep necessarily, but I at least appreciated it.
And that scene has some of the closest close-ups I have ever seen in any kind of porn.
Yes. Fingers going in those ladies' pussies. Like, I didn't even know what I was looking at for a while. Like, so close.
Yeah, I have to admit, I did kind of use my peripheral vision with a lot of scenes in this and some of the other ones where it was just like, I don't need this anatomy lesson on this scale. Like, every little bump, and I don't know.
And it was anatomical close-ups, which, when you've seen enough of these films, you just unfortunately kind of get used to. It's just part of that feeling of the filmmakers trying to establish what's really real. You have to see everything. You have to know that there is just absolutely no way that it's been faked. So, you know, that feeling of seeing all the skin possible in that scene.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's still being this novel thing where, like, an audience member is like, I really can't believe it. I'm seeing it. There it is. It's right on a big screen, and I'm here. Wow. Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they end up back at the guy's apartment, and that's basically where they together take revenge on him, which is another thing that shows that she wasn't, you know, getting off on her sexual assault. And, you know, it starts out as another long threesome sex scene, but ends with the, you know, revenge pegging, which is very different from how it's portrayed as this very erotic, you know, apex in Misty Beethoven. Right. And here it's, no, no, help. And he does not like it.
I believe I wrote in my notes, instead of Chekhov's gun, it's Chekhov's dildo. You know something's going to happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Have to wait and see.
Yeah. And then he disappears. Like, the next scene, she's living with the girl now. And I think the movie starts to become something even more different at that point.
Yeah. It kind of speeds along a little bit over, kind of glosses over time, it feels like. Whereas, yeah, they're like living together slowly. She's turning Lisa on to heroin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's no longer like this girlfriend or, you know, love interest character or savior or something. She's going into this downward spiral where she becomes this strung out junkie and who needs her fix. And I think that's probably the place that gives her the most room to actually do some acting. I'm not sure that she gets much of an opportunity elsewhere.
No.
But she was convincingly, you know, kind of like a strung out, you know, junkie in those last scenes, at least.
She's an okay dom, though, I will say.
I think Samantha Fox actually did have a substance abuse problem in the late 70s. So I think the sense of, you know, drug addiction seeming real was based on her own experience. So that's part of it. I also feel like Carmen's kind of like an angel of death. That's the feeling I get from her. So even from the very first moment we meet her, there's something mysterious and enigmatic and a little dangerous about her. And it just, of course, gets worse and worse as the film progresses.
Yeah, it's interesting because it starts out as like this healing presence. She's a friend. And then she, you know, sort of sets her free by ridding her of this master. Suddenly things have turned a little bit. Lisa is now sort of in the palm of her hand a little bit.
This is where the movie kind of kicks into gear for me a little bit, because I really didn't get much out of this up until that point, which is quite a stretch until we get here, really. Besides that photo shoot scene, I wasn't really finding much of interest, either as a story or stylistically. But at least, you know, once she's hooked on heroin, there's this long, like, woozy sequence where we got this, you know, like, fisheye lens shot. And that's where Dazed and Confused comes in. And this, you know, this random couple shows up that she starts having a three-way with. And it just has so much more, you know, atmosphere and uneasiness to it than the rest of the film.
Well, I just found it so icky and uncomfortable, though.
Oh, it is. It is. But I guess that was something for me. And again, when you have Dazed and Confused playing underneath it, it's like that gives you such a huge amp of atmosphere.
I just kept thinking about all the gross sex Robert Plant had, you know. I don't know. It just made me think about Robert Plant.
Well, I think Roger Watkins' interest in horror is what really kicks in those last 15 minutes. I mean, all throughout the film, I think there are these little touches that, like the photo shoot, that combination of sex and violence, that's part of it. But also in those last 15 minutes, that's where that really disturbing sensibility comes through.
Yeah, I'm torn about the ending. I feel like it's easy to have a knee-jerk thing and say that it's like it's a generic sort of fall from grace thing, like, oh, a sex worker gets hooked on heroin and dies, you know. And it is very like kind of anticlimactic and just a bummer on purpose, because that has been like a big conceit of movies about sex workers, even movies about just like queer people, people in alternative lifestyles and things like that. So I definitely felt that here, and that kind of, I don't know, it just kind of weighed down the last act. It made it feel more like paint by numbers or something. It became more like black and dark, I guess.
That's what makes his films, actually not just this one, but a lot of the other adult films he made, so interesting, because he wasn't afraid to go to these really dark places. I mean, by the end, Lisa is just emotionally naked. She's so vulnerable, and it's just so sad. It's overwhelmingly sad.
I think it ends kind of abruptly with, you know, Carmen handing her the needle and saying, here, you do it, and we just go back to see her casket one last time, and it's like the end.
Yeah, pow, goes in her arm, cut to casket, the end.
And it's got that song that plays near the end about how don't lose your soul. I mean, oh, that just hurt.
Yikes.
Oh, yeah, that was right before Dazed and Confused, and that made me forget about it. But yeah, I was wondering what that song was. Yeah, I did struggle, I guess, the way that it kind of pivots to being this drug cautionary tale at the end. The whole arc of the movie, I guess I had trouble making sense of, is that, you know, is this like a Reefer Madness kind of, you know, downward spiral? Is it about the revenge that she gets on that guy, or about how after the revenge, things only get worse? And it's hard for me to connect the whole movie together, because I don't feel like I ever got a sense of Lisa as a character and what she really, how her, you know, desires or weaknesses or whatever played into her downfall. It all just seemed kind of muddled to me. And I did appreciate how it took that, you know, dark, you know, dramatic approach to everything. But I just wasn't sure what the through line was supposed to be here. And this really could, even though I thought that Samantha Fox did a fine job in it, this, you know, could have benefited from a more like, you know, transcendent central performance. Maybe if they had gotten Georgina from The Devil in Miss Jones or something to sell that stuff even more. Yeah, I don't know. I was kind of scratching my head a little bit about what I was supposed to be taking away from this. Like, is she just a victim all the way through? Is she somehow, you know, tragically part of it? I needed something more.
I think that's just what you run into in a lot of Roger Watkins films, that life is just terrible. And that is the overwhelming thing. And no matter what you do, it's going to end badly. All of his films, both, I mean, well, all of the adult films, certainly. To be honest, I don't remember the ending of Last House on Dead End Street because I've tried to block it out of my memory. But all of his adult films are so bleak. And I think they're really just about creating a certain aesthetic and a certain mood. Sometimes they're extremely colorful. Like, there's another film called Corruption, which is even more boldly photographed. Like, just the reds and the greens, it's extreme. But the nihilism and the depression, that hits pretty hard. So I don't know if Roger Watkins even necessarily had a point. I think he just wanted to say that life is awful.
It is interesting that his vessel for having like a nihilistic sort of depressive message is through sex. Makes the sex very desperate and very like almost kind of like sad, because it is like more of like, this is like all we have. This is like all that we have that's good in this movie. Or the only like bit of like light that's in this movie is through sex. And the like really depressive aspects of the story outside of the sex scenes like only heighten that, I guess, now that I think about it. And it does make me appreciate it a little bit more. Yeah.
I read that he claimed, at least, that he didn't direct the sex scenes, or that he refused to direct the sex scenes. That's what it says.
Oh, I think I did.
I think
hear
like
that
on the Wikipedia. And I don't know if that's true. If it is, it begs the question of like, well, I feel like there's like 10, 15 minutes of this movie that isn't sex scenes. So what did you even do if you didn't have any hand in directing those? But there is, I don't know, the when he does start using those more ambitious like shot setups and visual things in the last 10 minutes, maybe that does seem like that's him finally engaging with it and throwing his style in. But I don't know, maybe that's, I don't know how true that is, that, you know, maybe he just made that claim at some point.
Well, I do think that considering that he didn't want to make adult films, maybe that is where all that cynicism and darkness comes from in the story. He didn't want to do it, so he just had to make it as dark as possible. I guess he figured that was the only way he could. He had to bring in the horror and the absolute bleakness.
It's a frustration.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I want to open up the floor again for any final thoughts about this movie or about porn or the era in general, and to answer our final question, which I'll start with, that this might have been my least favorite of the three. I think it was. Although I still wasn't crazy about The Devil and Miss Jones, and with this one, it really was confined to like two sequences that I found striking. So I would probably consider unwatching this, not literally, but in the sense of making that distinction for this podcast. I'm a Misty Beethoven guy all the way, but I'm glad I watched all them.
Well, I think that this is definitely better than The Devil and Miss Jones, if only because I am a noted Samantha Fox fan. So I feel like any movie with her is going to be entertaining. And she was in one of my favorite Doris Wishman movies, A Night to Dismember. So I just have to love Samantha Fox. And it's just such an, to me, interestingly shot film. And again, the darkness, the sadness, it's memorable. I mean, it sticks with you. You'll keep thinking about it. So, you know, not the greatest example of the era. Misty Beethoven is definitely better, but watchable for sure.
Yeah. I don't know if I would seek it out again. But I am glad I watched it. I think I do appreciate aspects of it. Again, like the music and those montages are exciting. And I agree, Jetta. I do really like Samantha is the name. Samantha?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. I really like her in this movie. If even just for vain reasons, I find her very attractive as a performer. That kind of keeps me from lowering this to a full-on unwatch. It was still like rather unpalatable, off-putting at a lot of places, which is its point. I get it. I enjoyed it to a certain extent for sure.
All right. Well, I really want to thank Jetta for joining on this and bringing all of this insight into this era and these three films in particular. It was definitely great to finally meet you after just, you know, reading stuff on Letterboxd all the time.
Thank you. I really appreciate your inviting me.
Yeah, and definitely, you know, check her out. She's the Iron Cupcake on Letterboxd and is quite a prolific movie watcher and reviewer. Is there anything else, I mean, that you wanted, you know, anything you wanted to plug or you know, say while you have the nation listening?
Two things, actually, that I thought of, and then I couldn't figure out where to put them in the conversation. One of the most entertaining anecdotes about The Devil and Miss Jones is Mark Stevens, who I mentioned earlier, who was in the threesome scene at the end of the film, was livid because he didn't get a close-up of his face in that scene. You see Georgina Spelvin and you see Levi Richards, but Mark Stevens wanted to be a superstar and he hated that he didn't get to have his face shown. So just something to think about. So if you ever rewatch that movie, you can just think about him just, you know, going crazy. Also, there is a film that I think, actually I'll say two films that for anyone who wants to continue watching what I think are among the best films of that era and genre, there's one called Blonde Ambition by the Amaro brothers, John and Lem Amaro. It's kind of like a musical without really being a musical because it has one song, but it just has that joyous feeling of being a musical. So it's just absolutely delightful and colorful and fun, and there are interesting costumes and sets and ice skating rinks and just like so many things you wouldn't expect to see in a porn film, even among porn comedies. So Blonde Ambition. I think the tagline was, if you loved Deep Throat and you loved Singing in the Rain, you're gonna love Blonde Ambition.
Hell yeah. I wrote it down. Everybody should write it down. Oh man, I'm watching it soon.
The second film was one called Roommates, which was by Chuck Vincent and also has Samantha Fox. And it got a glowing review from Judith Crist, one of the nation's leading film critics. So that's another drama, another interesting look at young women living in New York. I think those two films, Blonde Ambition and Roommates, I think those would be great entry points for people besides the films we've already seen.
All right. I would definitely make notes of those because, yeah, if nothing else, this got me more interested in being open to more of those. And I look forward to seeing what else lies in store.
I mean, I could honestly recommend films that I genuinely do think are unwatchable. So, you know, just be aware of that.
I mean, more porn episodes. Unwatchable in the fun way.
You know how there's like a whole thing, like an industry around like low budgets, like porn spoofs of mainstream films?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many of those exist for movies we've covered on the podcast.
Ooh.
Like you think there's a porn out there called like The Girth of a Nation?
Oh, Lord.
Probably.
Or like, hold on, I can think of another one.
Dick-a-more.
Mm.
Dick-a-more. Freddy Got Fingered Real Hard.
Okay.
All right. Seth, I'm kicking Seth out of the
I can keep going.
Freddy Got Fingered is its own porn parody title.
Oh, Fucky right, Games. Exactly. Fucky Games, directed by Michael Haneke.
Thank you, Tony, for bringing this up.
We'll workshop these, Seth.
Okay. See you later.
Unwatchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti, hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Krause. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening. Here I come again.